So, where do you even start with the Penguins? Like, where do you
start with the
start?
Goaltending?
You start with the goaltending? You don't start with the two star players that haven't scored a goal in 8 or 9 playoff games? You know,
yeah, but no one's looking at Crosby and Malkin and saying, man, these guys don't give us a chance. But looking at Marc-Andre Fleury and saying, man, this goaltender doesn't give us a chance. Like, we thought the Casey Cizikas goal in game 4 last year was the lowest we would see from Marc-Andre Fleury in the playoffs. Guess again. Like, put it to you this way. I know it was a joke, but this is kind of going around the NHL, this type of vibe right now. So I'm hosting Hockey Central at noon today with Kiprios and McLean, right? Mm-hmm. So we have Nick Foligno on, the big OT winner yesterday, the big hero, wonderful guest. Like, he's a guy that's going to transition to television when his career is done, like an Olympic diver into water. There will be no ripple, ladies and gentlemen. He is that seamless and smooth when he talks. So the first question is, of course, about the goal. How does McLean phrase it to Nick? He says, Nick, was that a shot or a dump-in? That's the vibe that's out there about Marc-Andre Fleury. And you know what Foligno said? He kind of laughed. I mean, what do you say, right? He said, and he said, well, yeah, it was a shot, but I didn't expect it to go in. Nobody expected it to go in other than Pittsburgh Penguins fans who have seen this movie before. Sorry. I don't think you get that same vibe when you look at Crosby and Malkin. You're not saying these guys aren't giving us a chance to win.
No, you're not. And but again, I wonder how. Here's what I wonder about Fleury, right? Like, do they take into account that for 3 games he was fine? For 59 minutes he was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not the same. It's not the same apocalyptic stuff as in the previous 2 playoff years.
Oh, you know what I mean? Like, man, that behind
the
net.
He's acquitted himself. Oh no! I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's a debacle. He cost him the game last night.
Yeah.
But do you feel like he played well enough in the previous games and in the previous 59 minutes in the game where you don't have that same here we go again thing that I think everybody in the media has right now?
No, because of what happened on those last two, in the Dubinsky goal and then the Foligno overtime winner. Because they were so bad. They were awful. I mean, awful decision the first hand to go behind the net to try to stop that puck. Awful decision to, I don't know, take your eyes off the puck. Awful decision not to let it just go around the boards. You know, it's a hard rim around. Just let it go. Just let that one go. You're that late in the game.
Let it go.
Let it go, man. Let it go. And then the 45-foot wrist shot, or dump-in, according to Doug McLean, that got past him is almost to the point of
he cost him the game last night. I mean, essentially, you're right. I mean, listen, you're essentially right. He cost him the game last night. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, Crosby and Malkin aren't helping.
I think there are other issues with this team. Like, I was talking to somebody this morning about Sid. And, you know, talking about, like, when does Sid get blamed? I think it was actually on Tim and Sid. And people were like, well, when does Sid get blamed for this? You know, when does Sid take his lumps for this team not performing up to snuff if they, in fact, get eliminated or they, you know, get eliminated this round or next round? And I agree with the Penguins fans who say that it's too simple to just say it's Fleury's problem, although last night it was. I mean, he lost him the game. There's a lot of blame to go around here. I don't know where you start. I mean, you start at Fleury, I guess, but then you immediately go where? Bosma? The fact that this team top to bottom roster wise doesn't have the horses that Boston has or LA
has.
That's not Bosma's issue.
That's Ray Shiro.
I agree. So where do you start?
You know, problem is the composition of the squad. They're not as deep as they should be / could be. And you wonder how much of that is, you know, trading picks and prospects. And they may do more because they have a glut of young defensemen that are on the horizon.
They do.
There's
They're
Harrington
solid
and Derek Pouliot.
Yeah.
Ole Madder's a good one, too. But, man, I mean, for me with that Penguins squad, and the two positions you mentioned right off the hop are two that are inextricably linked because one may cost the other his job. The battery between goaltender and coach is so tight. Like, that relationship is so intertwined to the point where we've made this point on the show before. Find me, you know, more than a couple of Jack Adams winners as head coach of the year that haven't had great goaltenders or really solid goaltender or good. Like, find me a Jack Adams winner. Like, find me a coach of the year that hasn't had a good goaltender. Find me a coach of the year that had a goalie that bombed. I'll wait. You won't, because those two positions are linked. It's the old cliche. Show me a good goalie, I'll show you a good coach. And vice versa. You know, so I think it all begins with on the ice with Marc-Andre Fleury. But you're right. There are greater issues the Pittsburgh Penguins face. Those are the issues of composition because their bottom six scares exactly nobody. Mm-hmm. No one. This is Crosby. This is Malkin. This is Kunitz. This is Neil. Stand the bunch.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. But again, we should probably, there's so much time and energy spent on dissecting the ills of the Pittsburgh Penguins that we don't spend enough time praising the look, I thought that Columbus was going to be one of these teams that came close to the playoffs but could not close the deal. I really did. Once it became a playoff race with Detroit, Columbus, Jersey, the Capitals, the Leafs when they were still in it, like I really thought that Columbus was going to be one of these teams whose sphincters clenched when there was a chance to make the playoffs, because they had sort of fallen into this pattern where the only big games they could win were against Detroit. And they won those games against Detroit. I mean, they masterfully played Detroit in the last couple of years. But every time there'd be a sellout nationwide, they'd get all tense and shit and not play up to snuff. Well, they made the playoffs despite all that. And now we're starting to see the maturation of a playoff team. Game three, admittedly, they didn't know what to do. It's like walking into a surprise party. Look at all the people here. And they're all here to see us. You know, they've did a great job keeping Penguins fans into that building. It was a very heavy Blue Jackets barn, and I really think, based on what their post-game comments were, that they didn't know how to handle it. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to transform that energy into positive energy on the ice. It became almost nervous energy for them. But you go through that, and you learn about it, and look what happened in Game 4. They got down 3-cob, as my good friend Jeff Merrick would say. And then what happened? They didn't quit. The crowd didn't quit. Bobrovsky didn't quit.
Richards
didn't quit on Bobrovsky. Nobody quit. And so what we saw last night, I think, was once they got back into that game, once they made it 3-2, now the fuse is lit. Now that crowd's not sitting down. They're out for it now.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the ability of a young team or a team that lacks Stanley Cup playoff experience to take that energy, to take those expectations, to take what the game gives you and stick with it until you get positive results. I know Fleury's gaffe is the reason why they won the game. He gave them new playoff life. He bestowed upon to them new playoff life. But the fact that they didn't quit, the fact that when Fleury played that puck, Ryan Johansson was already next to him, because that's how good the forecheck of this team has been in this series, is a testament to what the Blue Jackets have been able to do as far as keeping at it, even if the odds are against them. I've been endlessly impressed with how this team plays, and anybody who thinks this is a Cinderella thing or they don't belong on the same footing as the Penguins is out of their mind. Watch the games.
And you know what's a great moment as well, and this speaks to what you're talking about and the never-quitness of the Columbus Blue Jackets. We'll all focus in on the Foligno goal, 45-foot wrist shot that somehow goes through Marc-Andre Fleury. Hey, mind you, 45-foot wrist shot that didn't have any hot sauce on it, probably wouldn't break a pane of glass, that goes far side, okay, on Marc-Andre Fleury. We'll focus a lot on that. But a couple things happened before that that really set up that play that talks about what you're talking about, Wish. And it all begins with a block shot. Did you see where R.J. Umberger blocked that shot?
Yep.
Almost that was almost Ian LaPerriere in the face.
Yep.
That was right. Yep. When he was going down for that, I'm like, oh, like I had that, oh man, this is going to be ugly. Thankfully, it didn't catch him in the face. It was looking like it was. What does he do? Pops up and makes a really smart pass to Foligno to set it up. So it's a combination of guts and skill and vision on that play by R.J. Umberger that set the whole thing up.
You think about the guys that are on this Blue Jackets team right now that are making plays and sacrificing the body and coming through in the clutch. How many of these guys are the role players the Penguins lack right now?
That's a great question. That is a really good question.
Could you imagine the Penguins with Umberger? Could you imagine the Penguins with Dubinsky? Could you imagine the Penguins with any of the guys that are on this Columbus team? They couldn't have Dubinsky. I mean, let's be honest with you on that one, okay?
Oh, man.
Let me rephrase that. A Dubinsky type.
Somewhere Crosby just got a boner. We don't have to play against this guy? Oh, thank God. Oh, please. He's done a masterful job in this series. He's probably like the top one or two players in this series so far. Dubinsky's up to the point where you say to yourself, Dubinsky's had a bigger impact on his team than Rick Nash has had on his in that trade. Could you not say that?
For sure. And I look at that team and the way they play up front and the ability of these guys to just push the pedal down when they need to. And I say to myself, that's the type of player that Pittsburgh lineup lacks. You know, all due respect to a guy like Craig Adams, who is that kind of guy, but now there's some tread that's clearly worn off the tires. I mean, those are the types of players that this Penguins team needs, and they don't have it. They don't have that line. They don't have that line like Dallas has that they could throw out there like wrecking balls, or like or San Jose has now with their, you know, gloriously truculent, fist-filled line that they throw out there. The Penguins just lack it. They just lack that line and those types of players in this lineup right now. Listen. There's still every chance they're going to get past this round.
Yeah.
The idea that Fleury, I don't buy the idea that Fleury is going to go to Civville now. I think he's going to be all right. I hope so. I would hate to have to write that story for the third straight season, because now you're talking about the end of a guy's career potentially if he does this for a third straight season.
And you're talking about Dan Bylsma's job.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of sad stories to write if the Penguins do go out in this series, along with the, you know, overwhelming happy story of the Blue Jackets breaking through.
This may just very well be this year's edition of the Islanders series, where they get a really good scare, everybody's worried about the goaltender, and they squeak it out, and they move on to the second round.
Well, but you mentioned the goaltender, and for me that's the X factor in this thing, is we've yet to see Bobrovsky in any of these games be maybe even the third best player on his team. Like, we haven't seen it yet. I've been waiting for it. I believe that there is the opportunity for him to pull a Corey Crawford in Game 3 and play out of his mind in one of these games. Yeah. I just haven't seen any inkling of it yet. And I'm wondering if there's a part of me that says, you know what, Game 5 can go one of a couple ways, and two of the ways are Fleury gets gassed for a goal in the first 2 minutes of the game, or Bob becomes Bob for one night on the road when they need him the most. Like, there's a possibility of that happening. And
could be.
I don't know. It's a real weird place to be for hockey, hockey fans, hockey media. Like, the Blue Jackets are without question an amazing story, but life is so much more interesting when Sidney Crosby gets past the first round. And then again, life gets so much interesting when you have a team with the pressure and with the expectations of the Penguins flaming out in one, and what is the aftermath? Maybe it's, you know what it is, Merrick? Mm. As a guy who covers the Capitals year after year, maybe I'm just tired of writing that story. Maybe I'm tired of writing the story of the team that goes out in the first round and, oh, what will happen? When will the GM be fired? What happens to the star player? Maybe I'm just tired of writing that story. I have fatigue for that story, and that's why I'm kind of reticent to see the Penguins go out in the first round.
If you are Sidney Crosby right now, is there not part of you that's saying to yourself, I should have more than one Stanley Cup by now? And is my wagon now really hitched to this goaltender? Now, Jonathan Toews has got two Stanley Cups, but, you know, and you can say to yourself, well, you know, he's had himself hit to Antti Niemi, now Corey Crawford, and he seems to be doing just fine. Thank you very much. But if you're Crosby and you're looking at your career and you're thinking about the legacy that you're writing, sure, there's the two gold medals, sure, there's the one Stanley Cup, but are you not saying to yourself, I should have a couple of these things by now?
Yeah. Or at least I should have played for another one. I mean, for two.
Yeah, I've been to the final twice, and that's it. Mm-hmm. I should have more of this by now.
I don't know. Hard to put it on Sid.
It's exciting. At least it's an exciting series now. Like, at least regardless of what happens to the CBJs and all this, at least we have a really good series. Because last time they're in the playoffs, it was a dud.
Of the eight series, there are only two that aren't exciting. One of them is because it's already over. The other one is because we're one win away from a pieing, but everything else is incredible right now. I mean, what the Dallas Stars did last night to pounce on the Ducks at a moment of the Ducks' lowest point, which is not having Getzlaff late in the day. I mean, just that was a stunning development. The Solani thing wound up probably being a distraction, even though he's not been all that good. They took advantage of it, and say this about the Stars. Kari Lehtonen's a guy who could steal a series, and Jamie Benn right now is starting to round into form as being an MVP for them. He was great last night.
That goal.
Their lower lines are great last night. Yeah, but you talk about terrible goaltending. Whatever Fleury did in that game against the Blue Jackets doesn't compare to the goal that Freddie Anderson gave up to Vernon Fiddler. That was the worst goal of the playoffs that was surrendered last night.
Yeah, just squeak through, short side. He thinks he's got the post. He thinks he has the angle, everything wrapped up, and it somehow squeezed by. I would make the argument, though, that the goal by Jamie Benn is worse. Because the Fiddler goal is just one of those flukes, right? Like, he's just throwing it on net. You think you have the angle and you don't, and it squeaks through. The Jamie Benn goal, he's got a clear look at it. Like, we talk about the Nick Foligno goal last night against Marc-Andre Fleury. It's a bad goal. So is the Jamie Benn goal. Now, mind you, hugs the post. It's almost a perfect shot, but he's not screened at all. Anderson has a clean look at a wrist shot from 45 feet out, and he whiffs on it. Fleury's hearing a lot today. I don't know that it's not as many people watch the Anaheim-Dallas game, but that Frederik Anderson goal, the Jamie Benn goal on Anderson yesterday had an odor to it. That was awful.
Mm-hmm. So now you're down Getzlaff. You're down Robidas. You're in a situation where you're going to have to decide whether to stick with the rookie who was a sieve or go to the veteran who you decided wasn't going to give you the best chance to win in this series.
Or you just go to John Gibson, call it a day, say, hey, okay, all right, kid, see what you can do. Give the kid the keys to the Chevy.
Speaking of stories I don't want to write, Bruce Boudreau going out and one to the lowest seed in the conference
as he gets chirped
is one
by,
I don't want to write.
As he gets chirped by Timo Solani's son on Twitter.
Oh, God. But it's all, I mean, if Getzlaff can't answer the bell for game five, this entire series is thrown into chaos. It really has. I know Ducks fans have been very quick to, you know, yell at me when I call them a one-line team. But look what happened last night.
Showing it last night.
It was right there. And then, Chicago and the Blues. Once again, Merrick, we come back to this dirty little fact about the National Hockey League. What Brent Seabrook did to David Backes swung this series in the direction of the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yep.
The heart and soul of the St. Louis Blues was ripped out. Ken Hitchcock called Backes their Jonathan Taves. He's not inaccurate. And now we are 2-2 going back to St. Louis. And the Blackhawks are right back in it.
You notice when Backes goes out, you know who goes out with him? Alexander Steen, who's mm-hmm. a pretty big piece. And there's only so long you can rely on Vladimir Tarasenko, who has been freaking awesome in this series.
Just ridiculous.
Holy smokes, has he been good. Clark McClain.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Steen, by the way, because I wanted to talk quickly about TJ Oshie and how stats can sometimes lie. Okay? Because if you look at what Oshie's done in the playoffs, this is what you see. Nothing. He's done dick. He's played three games. He missed one to injury. He's a -3 with no points. Last playoff, 2 points in 6 games. He's got 5 points in 22 career playoff games, and he's a -9. See, look at that and say to yourself, well, he's terrible. He's a choker. If Jeremy Roenick was to ever comment on the St. Louis Blues, he'd be gutless, right?
Oh.
But he's done a lot of good. He's done a lot of good work, though. That's the thing about stats, man. Like he doesn't have a point in this series, but his screening Crawford has directly led to two huge goals being scored for St. Louis in this series. I think he's done some good things away from the puck and obviously in front of the net, where being no points in 3 games and being TJ Oshie, you might see some flack come his way. But I think that's one of those beyond the box scores kind of performances so far for Oshie.
Yeah, you're right. The story of this series, maybe the story of this playoff so far for me has been, it's still early, but it's the first round. The inability of any team to hold a lead. And you remember once upon a time, right? you get up 2 pucks and you go and hide, or you sit on the game until it hatches at the end. Like, that's gone. Leads no longer safe, and we saw it in Chicago last night. Like, didn't you think St. Louis was going to win that thing? As unlikely as it might have been, wasn't there part of you that said, like when they went up 3-2 in that third, man, St. Louis is going back 3-1. This thing's going to be over. Cup champs are done. And then they couldn't sit on it. I mean, I think it's great for hockey, personally. I don't know many people that love teams that sit on leads. But where did all that go? You know, where did that go? Where did the team sitting on leads go? Because that seems to be the theme. And listen, we just talked about the Blue Jackets and the Pittsburgh Penguins. Every game, a team's been up 3-1 and lost the lead. I love it, but then I love junior hockey. I love mistakes, and I love lead changes, and I love flow, and I like big errors that lead to excitement and things to talk about. Like, I don't know in some ways how you became a hockey fan, because what could you talk about in New Jersey? Like, really, I've always wondered this about you.
When I became a hockey fan, it was a different team. I was not someone who was simply watching the team and you know, they were mistake-free or whatever. Back when I became a fan, it was in the 80s. It was chaotic.
Oh, okay. I was thinking as a Devils fan, I was like, wow, look, there's that Peterborough Freeze again. This is exciting. Our guest is standing by, Wish.
Joining us now on the line, a man who played in many of those wars between the New Jersey Devils and the Philadelphia Flyers back in the day, and a man who was also part of many a war with the New York Rangers. He is Rick Tockett, and he joins us here at Merrick vs. Wyszynski to talk about the Flyers and the Rangers heading into their big showdown in Game 4. Hey there, Rick Tockett. How are you?
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're good. Hey, quick question for you before we get on to the Philadelphia Flyers and the Rangers. Just because you were his coach and know him quite well and helped him in his formative time in the NHL, when you saw Steven Stamkos in the first round against Montreal, certainly there was the frustration and Cooper didn't put Callahan with him until Game 4. What went through your mind about Steven Stamkos in the playoffs this year, Rick?
Well, even his first game, I thought it was terrific. Montreal is a really quick team. I like their defense. Obviously, Price is great. The playoffs, the star guys sometimes get a little too much flack early. I mean, you remember that Jonathan Toews and Kane last year, they didn't score for the first 7-8 games.
Yeah.
And your secondary scoring, the third and fourth line guys kind of can keep pressure off you. And it seems like when the star guys don't score early, and it's here in Philly, they're on top of Drew and those guys who haven't scored, they're going to get the flack.
Moving on to the Flyers and the Rangers, sir. What do you think has been the difference in this series so far? I think the snap judgment would be goaltending, although I think Emery played okay in his first two starts. What are your thoughts on the difference in this series so far as the Rangers hold a 2-1 advantage?
Well, the Flyers really haven't had a much flow to their game. If you look at Game 1 and Game 2, six penalties a game. They didn't really get a chance to use their bench. And in all fairness, I know you got to give the Rangers credit, especially in Game 1. They had the puck on their stick most of the game, a lot of puck possession. The Flyers have been chasing a lot. Flyers had a half-decent game in Game 3, but they're not getting enough, generating enough chances. Like, it happens every 5-6 minutes. You know, they don't get that barrage of chances like shift after shift. And I think that the Rangers obviously have a lot to do with it. Their penalty kill has been good, but especially their defense have been really good. I just think there hasn't been enough, and from the Simmons, Lacavi guys like that, to really sustain that pressure.
If you're Dan Carcillo's coach, like let's say you're Alain Vigneault right now, you're the head coach of the New York Rangers, and he does that celebration and comes back to the bench. Does Rick Tockett, head coach, say anything to Dan Carcillo? Or is he cool with that?
I would probably say so. I mean, obviously, I would probably say something. I mean, listen, he took that penalty. The fans were probably giving it to him. I'm a big believer. Don't give your other team bulletin board stuff. Don't say, I think Alain Vigneault has been great coach. I haven't, his quotes are great. He's really playing it close to the vest. I would probably say something. Yeah, I'm a big believer in the soccer style of celebrations. You don't want to get the other team riled up. I'm sure Danny was getting it from the fans and stuff, and he just lost it for a moment. It was a big goal, but the Flyers were actually coming on a little bit. That fourth goal really put them away.
And if Rick Tockett was still a Philadelphia Flyers player and saw Dan Carcillo do that for the Rangers, what might he have said to Dan Carcillo?
Yeah, well, things have kind of changed. But you remember 10, 15, 20 years ago when the game got 4-5-1, everybody tried to send a message for the next game. Mm-hmm. It's a different game, and it's better for that, too. We don't want the garbage. Even when you're up 4-5-1, you don't want the garbage stuff after. But, like I said, I'm not a big – I hated doing guys celebrate when they made it 7-1. I mean, to me, it's – you're rubbing it in people's face and that's your team's got to react to that and be better. They have to be better, and the Flyers on Game 4 have to be better, especially early, and be a lot smarter. You can't give power plays to the Rangers to start the game off every game. Eventually it's going to backfire, and it has in this series.
Is there a protocol? I mean, talk to us as a player here, Rick. Is there a protocol for how you behave when you're on the winning end of a 5 or 6-1 game and there's 5 minutes left, whether it's contact or whether it's wasting shots high from the point? Is there any sort of protocol when it comes to that, a sort of, you know, handshake amongst players that, hey, it's a blowout game, we know the outcome, this is what we agree we're not going to do?
Well, there's a lot of scenarios to that. I know there's coaches in the league now, they're up 5-6-1, and they're putting their star players on for power plays, last three, four minutes. I'm not going to mention a couple of those coaches, but to me, if you're going to do that, and listen, I understand if the other team's taking stupid penalties and you want to bury the team, but you know, I've seen some instances where the coach kept on putting the star players out, and to me, that I guess it's all fair now. I mean, don't be afraid to whack a guy in the hands. I mean, I have no problem if you're losing and you got the star player and they're dangling stuff to take a 2-minute slashing penalty. I mean, I have no problem with that. And I think a couple of coaches do that in the league, and I don't like that. But hey, listen, like I said, you know, the odds just to score as many goals as you want. And especially the playoffs. When a team's beating you pretty good, you're really trying to play for the next game. I mean, the last 10 minutes, you try to play for the next game, get your system back, get your composure. It seems to me a lot of teams have lost composure especially when they're up two goals. It seems like teams are losing composure, whether taking penalties or just letting the teams back into it.
Claude Giroux is an interesting guy in the sense that at the start of the season, you could attribute the Flyers' lack of success, I think, to the fact that he didn't score a goal for his first 15 games. Then he caught fire and I think played himself into the top three for the Hart Trophy. But I get the creeping sense that the longer he goes without a goal in this series, the more scrutiny he's going to get from the Philadelphia media. Where are you on Claude Giroux, a big-time leader for the Flyers?
Well, he wears the cap. He's the captain. He's, you know, one of the top players in the league. So, you know, if he doesn't get a goal, he's going to get scrutinized. But the one thing I do like about him, especially in game two, I thought he played even though he didn't score, he played a 200-feet game. He was dangerous at certain parts. I haven't seen a dangerous, he's been dominant the last 2 months. So he has been probably the best player in the NHL, and his stats show that. He hasn't been dominating, but he hasn't been a liability. There's been, you know, players on other teams, real star players, that haven't done that much scoring-wise, and they haven't done much defensively either, throwing pucks away. He hasn't done that. That's what I like about that, about him. He's matured in the fact that, hey, listen, if I'm not going to score a goal, I'm still going to play a complete game. But saying that, he needs help. I mean, he's getting no help from the secondary scoring, any help from anybody right now. And the one thing with Claude, he's not scoring. He passes way too much. He's, especially the Rangers, I think they had 28 block shots. Brian Boyle had 3 blocks and 1 penalty kill, which was amazing to me, how good that was. And that really turned the game around. But Claude's got to get a little more aggressive coming off that half wall if he gets it and just didn't pound the puck. I think that's when he's at his best, when he's very aggressive with the puck. And I think sometimes he pulls up and he looks to be too much like Gretzky, you know, tries to find guys instead of taking the puck net and shooting it. So I think you'll see a more aggressive Claude Giroux, especially on the power play. I think that's what Craig Berube is going to tweak going into tomorrow night and Friday with the Rangers.
Now, I have to use the word fight with quotation marks around it, but here goes, Rick. What did you make of the Voracek-Haglin fight the other night?
First of all, I didn't know Jake Voracek could fight like that. And number two, that's a 2-minute roughing. God, if we were allowed that, then I would have a lot of two-minute minors. I mean, that was awesome. I mean, Jake Voracek got a 2-minute, and I bet you he's kind of mad because, you know, sometimes those European guys like to have that major just to show, hey, I can fight. And I was very surprised how he gave it to him. I'll tell you what, it was great how he was mad. I'll tell you that he was mad.
Let me ask you this, because I was wondering about that as well, because the first thought that I had when I was watching the fight or the offsetting roughing minors was that they don't want to throw a 5-minute major on either guy, because if they did, Haglin would be out of the game because he didn't have his tie down on. Like, I'm thinking to myself, if I'm the official, I want to call it a 5-minute major, but if I do, then I have to throw Haglin out of the game for not having his tie down on.
Yeah, and that's the key right there. I think that's probably it. You know, that they didn't want to throw Haglin out. But you know what? Hey, the rules. I mean, that was a fight.
Yes.
And, you know, really, really, the way it should have gone, if you really look at that video, you know, Voracek kind of initiated everything, but Haglin had his jersey off, so Haglin should have got thrown out, and probably Jake should have got 2 extra minutes for he was kind of roughing him up pretty good. So, but you know what? I do like veteran referees when they do that, when they, you know, when it's not going to harm both teams, there's no danger for both. And, you know, sometimes you don't always have to go right by the Bucks. So I got actually no problem with it. So keeping both the guys in because, yeah, they're both good players.
Last one for me. I wanted to ask Rick Tockett about the a trophy that I imagine he's very familiar with, the Lady Bing. What do you feel about the Lady Bing? Because Merrick and I have often talked about how if you're going to vote for this award, if you're going to have this award, you might as well just give it to the referees and the linesmen to determine who the most gentlemanly player in the league is. As a guy who probably was never in the top five in the voting for the Lady Bing, how do you view this award?
You know, that's a great point. I don't know if they'd ever do that, but really it's the, you know, if you ask referees and linesmen, you know, who do they respect? And, you know, Lady Bing, it shouldn't be the guy with the least amount of penalties because, you know, I don't know if I agree with that because there's some guys like, you know, Jonathan Toews and, you know, Patrick Bergeron. I mean, they're classy guys, but they get out on forecheck. They might, they might accidentally trip the guy. They might get a penalty. So, I mean, so what if they get 20, 30 minutes in penalties? I mean, they're playing so much. I don't think it's who has the least amount. I think it's who's class. I mean, to me, like Patrice Bergeron, to me, is probably one of the classiest guys in the league. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, he'd probably get the most votes from the referees. So I do actually like that. I think that's a great idea. Because, you know, you talk to referees and they'll tell you, hey, this guy's a respectful guy. You know, yeah, he plays hard and he might get the odd penalty, but he's respectful on the ice and he handles himself with class. So to me, it's not really least amount of talent. It's the guy that, you know, who's the classiest guy that respects the game and the officials.
Rick, last one from this microphone, and we'll go back in your career for this one as well. And the answer that I usually come up with for this is maybe Troy Loney, for example. But who was the sneakiest, most underrated, tough player you ever played against?
Ooh, good question.
The most underrated?
Yeah, I mean, Troy Loney was not. I mean, every time I saw a Troy Loney fight, he always got a piece of someone. He didn't win all of his fights, but you knew you were in a fight when you fought Troy Loney. Who was the sneakiest, sort of most underrated tough guy that you played against?
Ooh, that's a great question. Because you have to underrated. I'm just trying to think over rivalries. I mean, so we had a lot of battles with New Jersey, and I remember a lot of those guys, and whether they're underrated, but like a Randy McKay,
yeah,
guys like that, you know, Kenny Daggett was underrated because he was very tough, but guys like that, they were tough. They weren't dirty. They, you know, you knew if you were out of line, they'd come after you. But if you played a straight up game, they were honest. So a guy like a Randy McKay type, I mean, you know, he was very, you know, he answered the bell and he could score some goals. And you know, you have some battles with guys like that.
Excellent answer. Hey, Rick, thanks, as always, for stopping by. Enjoy the rest of the playoffs. We'll catch up soon.
Anytime, guys. Take care. Enjoy it.
There he is, Rick Tockett, former NHLer, former pound-for-pounder. And, I mean, anyway, whether you watch his, you know, epic with Wendell Clark, which is still probably the best fight in the history of Maple Leaf Gardens, I would have to say, Wish. That was a guy just like to stand back mm-hmm. and throw him. You know, a lot of guys like to get in and seatbelt and, you know, just going to go through the motions here. Not Rick Tockett.
Stood Randy back McKay, and of course, for all you kids out there, Randy McKay was a member of the much heralded Crash Line with Bobby Holik and Mike Peluso.
Yeah.
That was the exact thing that Merrick and I were talking about off the top of the show, which is to have that fourth or third line that can go out there and raise hell. Randy McKay also had 24 goals in 74 games in 1998 and 23 goals in 77 games in 2001. But at no point did anyone ever give him David Clarkson's money, which is kind of interesting because they were kind of – correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I think McKay definitely dropped them more than Clarkson ever did.
Yes.
From a skill set perspective, though.
I think Clarkson – I know it's going to sound weird to anyone listening from Toronto, but I do think Clarkson has a higher skill set than Randy McKay.
He is similar players. I remember McKay McKay only had one move either. I mean, McKay and Clarkson only have one move offensively.
On the breakaway, it's fake forehand, go backhand every single time. Like money. Yes. It's like Mikko. Okay, folks, we're going to air this one of these days on Sportsnet. It's like the Mikko Koivu montage for shootouts. Take it to the bank. Starts, sweeps wide to the left and cuts in and goes backhand on his right every single time. I don't know how. And we put together a video of about 20 of them, shootouts of Mikko Koivu, every single time, exactly the same move. I'm guessing other teams do that by now. don't know.
No, no. For those who
those about to rock
the show live, we salute you. I want to apologize because I've made
again
an egregious. Well, no, not for
what
all
we
that
do
stuff.
Now. We got to apologize for now.
I've made a grave error in the question of the day.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, heart trophy.
In my haste, I've written heart trophy several times. When in actuality, I meant the Conn Smythe.
Yeah.
So the question of the day is actually about the Conn Smythe and not the heart trophy. PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. That was just Jeff Merrick on Twitter, #FVSW. A lot of people are saying, what a dumb question. Of course, it's Sidney Crosby. And I agree. It will be Sidney Crosby.
It's a pretty interesting
to
question
win
the
heart
day.
Trophy. My goal in the question of the day was to ask about the Conn Smythe. I failed. And I think that maybe that would indicate that I am not eligible for it. But the question of the day was, in fact, about the Conn Smythe and not the heart, even though I said the heart. Lisa from ATC. Wait, is there any doubt who the heart winner is? Need a better question of the day. I know. I know. It was my mistake. It's the truth. Sometimes we make mistakes.
Yep.
Anyway, Matt Riegler writes in, Vlady Conn Tara Smytho.
Oh, that's good.
Tarasenko is the only reason why the Blues are in this thing, to be honest with you. Like, he scored clutch goals. Yeah. They've scored, I think, 11 goals for the playoffs so far. He's got 4 of them. Leads all scorers in the playoffs. The question, obviously influenced by the Conn Smythe watch making its triumphant return to Puck Daddy this morning. To me, the leader on the board, and you can agree or disagree with this, Merrick, is Tuukka Rask. I mean, Rask's numbers have been off the charts. I think he's one of the reasons why they were so in control of Game 3 of that series.
Mm-hmm.
So Rask is my number one. The rest of the field, Rask, Marleau, Tarasenko, MacKinnon. MacKinnon, Stastny is an interesting debate because Stastny has the goals, but the ones that he scored pretty much are MacKinnon's work.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Johnson of the Jackets, again, you can go with Dubinsky or Johnson. I went Johnson because I think he's got better offensive numbers and also
Carey Price
basically
in there?
Helping out. I do not have Carey Price in there. I actually have Brendan Gallagher in there.
Okay.
Do you think Price has been that good?
I think he's really been excellent. Yeah, I really do. I think he was fantastic in
right.
that series.
I was more impressed with him at Bell Center than I was in Tampa.
Yeah, what I'm really looking forward to here, as much as you can get excited about a goaltending battle, is if Boston goes through Tuukka Rask versus Carey Price.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And listen, you could have given it to Price. You could have given it to Bork. I thought Gallagher was a good pace setter for them and did a lot with fewer minutes. And so he's on the list for me. But that could easily change. Marty San Luis, 6th. Don't look now, but he's got 2 goals, 3 assists, and he's looking like he finally is figuring out this thing for the Rangers.
And don't look now, but all of a sudden Brad Richards is a hockey player again.
Yeah, exactly. Going from healthy. Yeah, everybody forgets, you know, for all the Solani stuff yesterday about it being a healthy scratch.
Yeah.
Like, that was, remember when Brad Richards was? Remember that when we were talking buyouts and
mm-hmm.
end of careers and
still might happen.
Legs?
Still might happen, but who knows? And all of a sudden, Daniel Briere is a hockey player again.
Mm-hmm. Patrick Kane, number 8 on the list. Jamie Benn, number 9 on the list. And Paul Martin, who leads the NHL with 8 points in the postseason, all of them assists, is number 10 on the first Conn Smythe watch. Would you put Rask first?
Yes, absolutely. 2 goals in 3 games. The Boston Bruins, a perfect 9-for-9 on the penalty kill. The most effective penalty killer is always your goaltender. I will take Tuukka Rask, numero uno. Thank you very much.
Patrick writes in, Tuukka works in binary, all ones and zeros. That's a great nerd
Very good.
Answer.
Very good. Patrick's good. He's got good tweets, man. This guy.
Ek plays Jamie Benn or Tarasenko. Manny Silverstein, what a story it would be if MacKinnon won at 18. I agree. It would be an amazing story.
Matt Carlson, new MVSW tagline. Merrick versus Wyshynski, 0 days without offending anybody.
The podcast is young, sir. You still have another 20 minutes to go.
20 minutes for the deal.
Let's see here. There's a few others here. Jeremy writes in, if you're a Sharks fan, quick is your Conn Smythe winner for sure. MVP of the Sharks, hands down. Ouch. Playing with sticks, says Patrick Marleau, just to make JR squirm.
Oof.
What scared me more than anyone else on the Blues, which is saying something because dude looks like he's 12.
Hang on, I missed that first part because you got a little robot-y. Was that?
Tarasenko has scared her more than anybody else in the Blues as a Blackhawks fan. By the way, if Tarasenko's 12, what is Hurdle?
No kidding.
The fetus?
11-teen is what Hurdle is.
I mean, good. What a young lad that boy is.
Clark McLean, by the way, who was at the game yesterday. He was up in our in our booth in the Hockey Night booth with Doug. He's Doug McLean's son, Clark. All right, he lives in Chicago. I'm going to say this really simply. Clark McLean is Doug McLean's son. He works as a hockey agent for Justin Duberman in Chicago. He was at the game yesterday in the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast booth with Dean Brown and Greg Millen. Phew, got that out. Anyway, the point that he was making to his dad after is he sees a lot of Pavel Datsyuk and Vladimir Tarasenko. Do you see that?
Pavel Datsyuk and Vladimir Tarasenko.
Or he said something to the effect of he could be the next Pavel Datsyuk. He doesn't look as slippery to me as Datsyuk or as crafty.
Yeah.
He just looks like just flat out straight line good.
Is he going to be as good defensively though?
Who knows? He's still a kid. He hasn't gotten a hockey finishing school
yet. That's obviously, that's the thing that I would need to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing I would need to see. Because he's great. I mean, but I mean, you know, where's the line between, you know, could he be Bure? Could he be Fedorov? Could he be Datsyuk? These are all the things that you have to wonder when you're looking at a player and
which
the development of different facets of their game.
When you say Bure, you also have to add which Bure?
Oh, Candace Cameron Bure. the one who was on Full House.
Because I mean, Valerie was a pretty good player too. Nowhere near, you know, the greatness that was his brother Pavel, but Valerie was a pretty good player too. Don't know that he had the work ethic that his brother had.
He's basically the Jim Belushi of hockey.
That's right. But you know what? He's got a beautiful family and he owns a vineyard, so he laughs last.
He does.
He wins.
What a great. I wish that was the go-to line for guys that just simply aren't as good as other players.
Yeah, but look at this. Look at this gorgeous family I have. And look at I'm on a vineyard. I live my life on a vineyard in California. You know what I do when I want a glass of wine? I go to my backyard.
Eric Karns was never as good as Zdeno Chara, but he owns a beautiful vineyard with his family.
But that's life. Just be happy. You know? Who cares? Got more goals, won more trophies. Look at my life. Live in the moment.
Oh, that's the best. Yep.
Honestly, dude, like,
you know, Ville Leino never became the next Thomas Vanek, but he does have a beautiful vineyard with his family.
He does, too. Yeah, that's where Igor Larionov's got everyone taken, because he's one of the greatest hockey players of all time. Wine connoisseur.
He's produced many good vintages. Straight and tie. Good vintages.
Wow. Oh, I got
many
you.
Many.
All right, yes.
Straight and tie. Yes. See, I told you. There was a good 20 minutes left in the show before we defended somebody. So. Yeah.
I don't think Alianko would be offended by that. I think it's quite flattering.
Checks breath, straightens tie.
Checks breath. Where those Tic Tacs go? Damn it. Around here somewhere.
Martin writes in, your QOD mistake is as bad as Peggy Kaczynski asking Kane about OT winners.
Okay, I read briefly about this. So what happened? She asked if Kane had scored any overtime goals before?
We have the video on Puck Daddy. I think Harrison blogged it. And yeah, basically what happened was that a reporter in Chicago asked Patrick Kane after the game, Patrick, was this your first overtime game winner? And Patrick Kane responded, I'll have to check that. I think I've got a couple.
That's a good answer. Good for him.
Good for him for not, you know,
burying her.
Doing what
good
other athletes would have done in that situation.
Stanley Cup 2010.
Do you even watch hockey?
Are you new?
I mean, if that was Duncan Keith who was on the receiving end of that question, you know, we would have heard something about her being back in the kitchen because that's how Duncan Keith rolls. But Patrick Kane, with some class, mama's boy, answering the question as he should. But so she works for NBC Chicago. She explained in a tweet that she has since deleted that she was trying to lead Kane into talking about his past winners. I did ask Kane about game-winning goals in overtime, trying to lead him into talking about the others. He didn't, and question fell flat. The actual question again was, I repeat, Patrick, was this your first overtime game winner? Now, it wasn't asked like a joke. It wasn't asked in anything else that would indicate that it was a laugh line. It sounded like a straightforward brain fart, which happens. It's okay.
It's all right.
But as one of her reporter buddies points out, for those wondering, Peggy covered and interviewed Kaner after all three of his game-winning overtime postseason goals in Philadelphia, L.A., and St. Louis. I think it was a brain fart. It was kind of embarrassing, but I'm the guy who couldn't remember if Daniel or Henrik was the goal scorer on the Simmons podcast, so I'm never going to shit on somebody else's momentary lapse of befuddlement.
Whatever. Who cares? We all make mistakes.
Although there was this one time when a reporter who a lot of people around the Capitals didn't like was in the locker room after they had been eliminated, and he referred to a player that had been there for a couple of years. He was asking a question. Referred to a player that had been there for a couple of years as a trade deadline acquisition this year. Like, asked them basically, what did it feel like to come to this team at the trade deadline?
Yeah.
And the audible groan from the press corps and the visual roll.
This is in a scrum after
they were eliminated that night. It was palpable. It happens sometimes, you know?
I'm not quick to judge. I've made a lot of mistakes too.
I give Kane, like you said, hit the nail on the head. Like, I give Kane a multitude of credit for just hanging in and not trying to show up somebody who asked a dumb question.
He took a situation that could have been really bad and made it good. It should be applied.
Probably helped that he had the game-winning goal.
He was in a good mood. It's a lot easier.
Before he put over Patrick Kane as a paragon of virtue, I don't know how that question would have been handled if they had lost 4-3 in overtime.
It was Duncan Keith, the response would have been, this is a funny looking kitchen we're in. Looks like a dressing room.
Anyways, so that happened last night. It is what it is. Of the Conn Smythe watch people, the Patrick Marleau one obviously is the most interesting for me, because the idea that the Sharks could win the cup and he would win the Conn Smythe is something I predicted, but also something that would be fascinating to see. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how all these things shake out, obviously contingent on their teams continuing on and winning. Could you ever give Conn Smythe to a guy that didn't make the cup final, Jeff Merrick?
Oh, excellent question. There was some, I remember, which year was it? The year that Doug Gilmour, playing with the St. Louis Blues, led the league in scoring, even though he wasn't in the Stanley Cup final. There was some, you know, groundswell of support for Dougie in St. Louis. But no. You have to go through all four series in my mind. Right.
The year the Minnesota Wild made the conference final. It was 2003, I think it was.
That's right.
And then it was Devils and Wild. I mean,
against
Devils and Ducks.
Against the Habs.
I made the case that Marian Gaborik deserved Hart Trophy consideration for the way he put that team on his back offensively through three rounds.
He wouldn't be your first choice, though.
No, not at all. No. But I don't have any problem giving the Conn Smythe to a player on the losing team, by the way. A guy, I think you have to be in the final in order to win Conn Smythe, but
that was one
I don't
of the,
have any problem giving I remember, it to a player on the losing team.
I remember that. That was the year I was trying to bang the drum about awarding the Conn Smythe trophy to two people, a defense tandem, to Carney and Soleil, who as a pair, I think, were as good as we've seen in the playoffs up to that point for a long time. Can we give the Conn Smythe trophy to a pair of defensemen?
That you give it to the player on the losing team if there is nobody on the winning team that's deserving of it.
Like 2003 with Jean-Sébastien Giguère?
Well, I'm saying that in 2003 there was a player who I thought was the best player in the playoffs.
That scored the cup winner, Mike Rupp, of course. How could I forget?
He got outplayed in the final by the opposing goaltender. But that's okay.
Who threw a shutout in Game 7? That guy?
I still think Pronger should have won in 2006.
Or in 2010, the Chicago Philadelphia series.
People are always talking about how it could have easily gone to Rolison for that run as much as it could have gone to Pronger.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I still think I would have given it to Pronger. In 2010, he wasn't good in the final against Chicago. I had no problem with him not winning it in 2010.
He was too busy stealing pucks.
Taves, you know.
I would have given it to Duncan Keith that year.
Taves won it by default, it seems like. I mean, he was sort of like the hey, he's the captain, and he did some good things here and there. Let's give it to him. kind of pick.
I remember one person who, I won't say who it was, one person who voted that I was having a conversation with, I talked them into Duncan Keith, and I said, is he going to vote Keith? And he said, no, because Jonathan Toews is a much better representation for the NHL as a Conn Smythe Trophy winner.
Whoa.
I know. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you who it was after the program, off the air. But I was,
after the
I
break.
Was shocked. Like, oh what? God. Really?
Like, yep. Wow.
I know.
Okay.
I know. Because I there's Duncan Keith with the long hair and no teeth.
Was this was this gentleman? I'm assuming it's a gentleman.
That's as far as I'm going to say. I was going to say it was a gentleman. Yeah.
I'm assuming this gentleman was not voting for the Conn Smythe in 1995.
let me do some quick math. No.
All right, just checking. Because I feel like maybe if that's the criteria for the Conn Smythe, I don't know, just thinking out loud here, Claude Lemieux probably wouldn't have won it. That's what I'm thinking.
Guessing not. Oh, yeah. No, that was a really weird conversation.
Speaking of Jonathan Toews, the nominees for the Selke Trophy came out today. The best defensive forward in hockey, awarded to the forward who best excels in the defensive aspects of the game. It's Toews, Bergeron, and Kopitar. I should say it's Bergeron and two other guys, much like right. the McKinnon thing with the Rookie of the Year. I mean, I don't think there's a chance in hell Bergeron doesn't walk away with this thing. But the support will be there, obviously, for Kopitar and Toews. The one thing, and I wrote about this on Puck Daddy today, but I wanted to bring it up here too. The one thing I don't quite like about the Selke voting and the way the NHL handled it. Or I should say not the voting, but the presentation of the finalists. I know a lot of people in the PHWA are using advanced stats to figure out the Selke and the Norris. I mean, there are ways now that you can go beyond plus-minus faceoffs, shorthanded time, and that kind of thing to figure out who the best defensive players in the game are. My problem is that the explanation for the NHL as to why these three players were nominated encompassed such scintillating supporting details as face-off wins, plus-minus, minutes played shorthanded. That's it. Really.
Yeah, but to a casual audience, or to one who's not, you know, down with the hockey sabermetrics yet, I think a lot of those, you know, advanced stats that you could bring up, you know, I don't know that the education has been there en masse that people understand what those stats mean.
I think there's a way to present it to a general audience in the sense that, like, for example,
in one paragraph.
Well, yeah, one paragraph. Like, because how hard is it to simply say, you know, with statistic backup, to say that a player faced the toughest competition on his team, which is what Kopitar does, mm-hmm. which is what, you know, Bergeron does. Well, I think that you could say that's especially true for the Norris. Like when, you know, when the Norris comes out and Duncan Keith is, you know, one of the finalists, the argument against Duncan Keith is that Yarmolson and Oduya get the tougher defensive assignments. So it's a very salient point. But I don't know. It just bugged me that we're in a place right now as voters where we're using all of this stuff, and yet you can't even find it on NHL.com, and they don't even acknowledge it in talking about a position where the advanced stats basically can
That'll
define
change.
The effectiveness of a player.
That'll change. Don't you think it's all – I mean, that's the way the worm is moving on this one.
Mm-hmm.
That is all changing. All the broadcasters are doing it now. I would suspect, and I've already had conversations with people at Sportsnet about next year's package and how we how we bring in advanced stats and make them part of the game presentation. Everybody is doing this, and there's no reason to believe that the NHL – will lag behind on their website. They just won't. It will be there. I'm not saying that it's going to put, you know, Gabe Desjardins and Tyler Dello out of business, but I'm saying that, you know, people are paying now so more attention than ever to what the Dellos and the Desjardins Gabe Desjardins are doing.
Now that you've seen the top three for the Selke, where do you think your boy Ryan O'Reilly ends up in the voting?
Probably fourth or fifth, I would imagine. But my bigger issue is this year, again. It is Bergeron and everybody else. I get that. But let's talk about the everybody else. This award has been handed out 35 times.
Uh-huh.
Okay? This was an award that was created for a winger by the name of Bob Gainey. who the NHL looked at and said, this guy is so good at what he does, but we don't have a way of rewarding him for it. Let's create a trophy for him and that particular skill set. Mm-hmm. Hence, the Selke Trophy was created. Of the 35 times that this trophy has been awarded, and Gainey ran the table from 78 to 81 as a left winger, how many times has it been given to a centerman of the 35 times it's been handed out?
I'm going to go 33.
26.
26.
Craig Ramsey won it once. Dirk Graham, Bob Gainey, of course, we all know about Yuri Lehtinen as well. Is there room for Hossa and Gabe Landeskog in this conversation?
There should be room for Hossa. Landeskog's an interesting one, but there should be room for Hossa, for sure.
The block shots are there. The takeaways, if you value that, are there. The hit stats are there. The points are there.
And Hossa, as far as the quality of competition and things of that nature, is second only to Taves across the board and a lot of stuff, including puck possession. Yeah, I think Hossa's right there. I would need to see more from Landeskog. I'll be honest with you, I didn't pay enough attention to his defensive side of the game
versus someone
like O'Reilly, for example.
I would put Hossa above Landeskog in that category going away. But I just would like to see more wingers part of it because this isn't the best two-way center award. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, you talk about, you know, face-off stats meaning so much. Well, not so much if you're a winger.
Well, and that's an interesting point because it's almost as if they're at a competitive disadvantage. Because honestly, you know, when you talk about defense, this goes beyond the Selke Trophy. When you talk about defense, you're essentially talking about a defensive center. The best defensive players in the history of the National Hockey League at forward are centers. And we know this because they're the guys that you put out there for a big faceoff. You know, Joel Otto, Peter Zezel, you know, these guys become legendary names for us because of their ability to win a draw or to shut down an opposing center. It is unfortunate that defense amongst forwards has been whittled down to what does this center do in the faceoff dot, and then what does he do to shut down the other center that he's playing? That's the other aspect of it too. You know, Joel Otto is only as good as how much he dampens the offense of Wayne Gretzky, that kind of thing. So the entire thought process of how to measure the defensive prowess of a forward boils down to the center position. And I agree with you. I don't know how to break that mold, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I had a really interesting tweet from someone while I was in Chicago because I was, you know, tweeting about Hossa's game. And every time I get to watch Marian Hossa live, I always marvel about it. And I got to send tweets out about it because I love this player so much. But this person was from Chicago. I can't remember her name. And if you're listening, I really do apologize. The tweet she sent me was, every time someone goes to Chicago Blackhawks game, like, if it's your first Blackhawks game, if it's your fifth Blackhawks game, your 10th Blackhawks, you're going to see the Blackhawks live. Just for, if you can do it the whole game, God bless you. But even just for a period, only watch Hossa. Mm-hmm. Like when he's on the ice, don't look at anyone else, just watch Hossa. And it's true. If you only watch Marian Hossa for a full game live, you'll come away blown away at what this guy does. And it's not just the offensive side of the puck, it's going back the other way and the defensive side of his game. It is remarkable what this guy does with that strength and that, you know, that large frame and those soft hands. It is staggering when you just, we should probably do this on next year in the national package, make it as a sort of a side note. You know, this would be kind of a cool thing to do as an extra for the website. How about this? Pick a player ISO cam and make all that available just like scouts do. Right, just like trainers do.
They occasionally do that on NHL.com. Like, but that's
just for a single skater.
Yeah,
for the whole game.
But it's StarCam though. It's not like it's not like they're gonna pick somebody who you're supposed to explore the defensive. Like, it's Ovechkin or Crosby or whatever. Right?
Oh, okay. See, I would do Marian Hossa going away and just watch video. I mean, scouts have this. I mean, when players go back in the dressing room on their iPads, you know, a lot of teams do this on their iPads. By the time they're out of the shower and they're dressed, they have all of their shifts, right, already loaded up onto their iPad. They can watch, you know, on the bus back to the hotel.
Interesting.
It's true, man. Why not do that on our website? Oh, it's an idea. I'd watch that. You'd geek for that too, wouldn't you?
I'd geek for that too. Yeah.
Yeah, you totally would.
I totally would. All right. Real quick tonight, we've got ourselves. By the way, I am. Not someone who can speak all that freely about Pierre Maguire these days because Yahoo and NBC have ourselves a nice little relationship. I will simply say that some people like to hear trivia during games and some people don't. But I would compel you to go check out something that producer Josh made for Awful Announcing.
Steve Lepore's piece, right?
Yeah, yes.
I saw it today, yeah.
A supercut of all of the mentions of junior hockey teams and biographical information by Pierre McGuire over a two-game period. And it is brain-melting.
Let me ask you this, though. Okay, because I was talking to Nate Ewell about this on Twitter as well, from College Hockey Inc. I don't mind the idea of it. You can argue that it's too much, that it's like trying to take a drink from a fire hose, and I understand that. But in theory, though, you don't mind occasionally dropping in where the guy's from or where he played junior, where he played Division One, do you? Because it does create a link to somewhere else. Because I think for a lot of casual fans, hockey players come from a factory somewhere in Sudbury or New Hampshire.
Well, it depends. Like, it matters to let me speak as and try to put myself in the mindset of a casual American fan. Like if my friends who are mostly basketball fans or something are watching a hockey game, right?
Right.
I think they'd care to know where a player played NCAA hockey. Mm-hmm. I think they'd care to know where a player grew up, maybe. I don't think they give the first shit about the Brandon Wheat Kings or who coached them with the Brandon Wheat Kings or who that coach then coached 3 years later with the Brandon Wheat Kings or what player from the Brandon Wheat Kings they play with during the offseason running sand dunes or what Brandon Wheat King they had on their wall when they were a kid because they always wanted to be a Brandon Wheat King. I don't think they care about that. So we're not there yet as a society when it comes to junior hockey. We like World Junior because we're good at it. We like the Memorial Cup because Merrick tells us to watch it. But we don't give a shit about the Brandon Wheat Kings. Yet.
How dare you? You don't care about where Travis Hamonic came from. Travis Hamonic, one of the great, you know, shutdown defensemen, the man that smothers Crosby every time the Islanders play. You don't want to know that he plays junior with the Brandon Wheat Kings.
It literally... Don't put me down this rabbit hole, man. I can't get myself.
I'm not. Pull yourself out of it. Pull yourself out of it.
It's like listening to an audiobook of a Tolkien novel. And then Frodo begot blah blah blah. Who begot? It's like that.
Come
it's
back.
Like why?
You've
like,
gone too
I'm
far.
Trying to watch a playoff game and I'm You've listening to a family tree being presented to me from some guy, some disembodied voice. Is telling me about the it's like reading the it's like reading someone's bio from a playbill before a musical, and yet there's a playoff game going on.
I'm pulling you out because I'm reading a tweet. Phil Rolston submits, as an Ottawa fan, what the hell were they thinking trading Hossa for Heatley? I'll tell you exactly what they were thinking. Hossa just killed them in arbitration. Remember that? It's Hossa took him to arbitration. He won. He got on the plane. And by the time he landed back in Slovakia, he was an Atlanta Thrasher. That's how bitter Brian Murray was. That's what that trade was all about.
Hockey band names. What the F are Brandon Wheat Kings? Jeez. Steven Castaneda. I don't think they would know who the Brandon Wheat Kings are. That's just, it's one example of many people.
Why are you going to pick on the Brandon Wheat Kings of all people? Kelly McCrimmon's squad.
Matt Calvert was a Brandon Wheat King. I know that. Niles Felderbusch writes in, I'm solidly in the trivia is awesome camp, but I'm a diehard hockey fan of every level. Look, I'm fine with trivia, but like Merrick said, there's a difference between a fine glass of wine on occasion and drinking from the fire hose. That's the issue with it.
That was my only point that I was making today with Nate.
Do you know how annoying it is to have me as a friend? Let me tell you exactly how annoying it is to have me as a friend.
All right.
I'm always trying to make a joke. Do you know how annoying that is in life? To have someone that you can't even have a conversation with without knowing that the wheels are turning behind their eyes to make the next joke? And I fully recognize how annoying that is, but that's how I'm wired. Do you know how annoying it is to listen to hockey commentary knowing that no matter what occurs in a game, there is going to be some pointless pop-up video bit of trivia that will have to be attached to that analysis just to show you he's smarter than the rest of us.
That's why I've always maintained, I've made this point before, I think Pierre McGuire would make an excellent podcast. He does know a ton. And he knows a lot of people. He knows a lot of history. He knows a lot of background. I think McGuire would make a fascinating podcast.
I would only listen to that podcast if McGuire did it like Steve Dangle and talked to himself in different characters. great goal right there from Matt Calvert.
Hey, Pierre, where did Matt Calvert play as junior?
Oh, I'll tell you exactly where he played as junior, Pierre. He played it with the Brandon Wheat Kings.
Hey, Pierre, that's really fascinating information.
I'm getting away from this topic because I'm going to read another tweet. Watch this one from Ian McLaren. Quote, I'm pulling you out because I'm reading a tweet. Hashtag hockey Twitter porn. I'm pulling you out because I'm reading a tweet. we're getting much more mature here as the years go on. On the little podcast here.
I believe a glimpse into Alyssa Milano's life. Thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I am Jeff
Merrick. She has a lot of Twitter followers, you see.
Yes, I understand that. That's right. Thanks for helping us there, Ian, with that
one. Alyssa Milano's got a lot of Twitter followers.
Hey, Pierre, what show was she on?
Oh, she was on Who's the Boss, Pierre.
Oh, that's great to know.
You see, his hat's turned sideways, so he's a different person.
Oh, I know. He's a different guy. He turns his head, too.
Turns his...
It's like the 10
people out there who get the Steve Dangle joke.
No, go watch go watch Dangle videos. Awesome. They're freaking hilarious, and he's a great dude. Seriously, if you don't know Dangle, Steve Dangle,
Dangle
go.
Always gets... Dangle's bat signal gets thrown in the air, too, when he hears that we're doing the bit.
Good. I expect to get a text or tweet from Dangle.
It's one of those where I never know if he's offended by it or if he's honored by the fact that we do this bit.
He should be honored. It's great. You kidding? I love Dangle's videos. Dude, I love them so much. When I was at HockeyNet, I got him on a playoff preview show. I sold it in to Shirley Najak, our executive producer, to get him on. That's how much I love Dangle's stuff. It's freaking hilarious.
Hey, Phil Kessel's played really well this season. I think he's probably a Hart Trophy candidate.
Yeah, but what about Bozak? He's pulled them back.
Well, that's a good point. I don't know. Maybe he's...
I think you're doing Family Guy.
Your hat's turned sideways.
What is Family Guy voice for you when you do the alter
totally
ego of Steve Dangle?
When he turns his hat sideways.
He's like.
I think we should probably keep Carlisle around. I think he's a pretty good coach.
He's terrible. Don't keep him around. He's stupid.
Oh, that's a good point, Steve. I didn't think about that.
That's your Steve Dangle impression.
Hat's turned sideways. Different guy.
Yeah. Well, it's different like Clark Kent, right? Takes off his glasses and no one knows who he is. That guy looks familiar. I just can't place it.
It's been so long. It's been so long since we did the Steve Dangle.
I know. It's so true. Has Dangle been on the podcast?
I don't know if he has or he hasn't.
F it. Let's get Dangle on tomorrow.
Hey, I should totally come on this podcast.
No, you shouldn't. Not enough Leafs talk.
Those guys are assholes.
That's a good point, Steve. They don't talk about the Leafs enough.
Oh, those jerks. Go listen to a Terry Ryan interview. Turn you right around.
I'm going to do it like James Lipton on Inside the Actor Studio and have Dangle answer a question and then be like, and now if we can hear from the Steve Dangle with the hat turned sideways, what would he say to the answer to this question?
Right, stupid, papa.
I'm just glad that Steve Dangle finally got you away from talking about your colleague, Pierre McGuire.
Oh, and another thing about Pierre.
Okay. No, you're done.
I'm done. That's true.
I'm pulling you out because reading a tweet. I'm pulling you out because I'm reading a tweet.
Thanks, everybody. We will talk to you soon. Bye.
Woo!